actors to try to delight.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at JinxLaw. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. I am back here in the deep, dark confines of the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4 with my friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. You were just here like it was almost like just a week ago.
Just last week.
And then before that, it was like a week before that with Bill Owsley.
Correct. We did three segments that night with Bill Owsley, and we talked about the Chicago-Kansas City connection. And we also talked about Joey Doves Iupa, last time. We've done one other, we've recorded one other set of shows, and I have a little more editing to do on that. I need to give a big shout out to Connor Cardinal. What was it? All of a sudden, my brain's lost it. I think it's Edmonton. But I remember he works for a woodworking company or a floor company. Probably a wood floor company. Need to send him a t-shirt. But you know, I found out it cost about 25 or 30 bucks to send a t-shirt. And Connor, if you're listening to this tonight, I just haven't got down there to find out exactly how much it cost. If it's not much more than that or about that, I'm going to send you the t-shirt anyway. But I hate to say it. I forget that listeners from all over the world. But I'm not going to be able to make good on that offer to send a t-shirt or a DVD because it just cost too much money.
Folks that are going back and listening to the archive and saying, well, he said he'll send, I gave him the review because you've got fans in England.
I know, England, New Zealand, Australia.
You got a story published in a true crime.
Norway, Finland. I mean, I've got them all over.
We got to do something with like the digital download. Give them something special, but we can only give it to you.
How about this? If you're from another country and you can think of something that I can do for you, that's a digital download or a digital, I can give you a copy of a particularly interesting wiretap transcript as a PDF file.
How much of the actual wiretaps like that we use clips here, but there probably was more than clips in your archive.
No, I've got about a foot tall stack of transcripts and there's audio for every bit of that. So I don't know how many hours and hours. Hundreds of hours of wiretaps that most of them say hardly anything that you could understand unless you were part of the conversation. I don't know how many hours I spent on those things trying to glean out interesting little tidbits out of it. The ones I use for my movie particularly.
Yeah. So the ones that I pulled out that you had shared with me for this episode episode that we have.
More.
And I use those as part of a bumper, which was an interesting conversation talking about the skimming in Vegas and getting the money out of the slot machines. So there's actually, I don't know, we have to figure that out. What's a good digital gift for people that give us a review on iTunes.
So if anybody's got any idea out there why, you can get on my website and contact me.
We're on Twitter at JinxLaw.
Twitter at JinxLaw. I'm on LinkedIn. Joey Iupa or Joey Doves out of Chicago. You know, he was such a he was so close to Kansas City, but yet so far in many ways. We never really seemed to talk to him other than the one time, if you remember, Nick Savella and I believe Corky went along. They went up to Nick's nephew's house, Anthony Shiovola, and they were going to have a big meeting. And they wired up, they put a hidden microphone, a bug, in the upstairs because the intelligence said they were going to meet upstairs, so the probable cause on the affidavit for the technical intercept said they were going to meet upstairs. And Joey Iupa gets there, and he has a heart condition, and he doesn't really want to walk up those stairs, so they meet downstairs. And as Bill Owsley said, I just wish we could have listened to it. Even if we couldn't have used it, I just want to hear the head of the mob in Chicago have a long meeting with the head of the mob in Kansas City just to see what they say. We're going to continue down this path and studying a little bit more about Joseph Ayupa.
Well, certainly setting it up in terms of if you'd listened with the episodes that we had released about Nick Civella and how he, as the Kansas City mob boss at the time, really was anointed by Chicago.
Yeah, it seemed that way. It sure seemed that way. And we've always been the little brothers of Chicago, and we've always looked to them, but, you know, maybe not as a junior partner, but as a slightly lesser partner in mob activities, more than Cleveland and more than Milwaukee. Matter of fact, Bill said Nick Civella used to badmouth right to his face the Frank Ballesteri, called him Fancy Pants, and he did not like that nickname. They nicknamed Frank Ballesteri Fancy Pants because he was such a dapper dresser. And he didn't like that nickname, and Nick Civella would say that right to his face. So, but with Chicago, there was a certain mutual respect, and like you say, Aaron, he did go to Chicago and hide out. Nick did. Nick Civella went to Chicago and hid out when he was in trouble with the Kansas City mob, and when he came back, it would appear that Chicago paved the way, that the mob hierarchy in Chicago, probably Anthony Big Tuna or Anthony Joe Batters Accardo, probably paved the way with a guy named Tony Gizzo for Nick to come back and move right in as Gizzo's driver. And shortly thereafter, Gizzo becomes the boss, and so Nick's now the driver for the boss. And shortly after that, Gizzo dies, and guess who becomes the boss of Kansas City? And it's all because of this Chicago connection, it would appear. So as we go down this path, I did this Freedom of Information Act request on Joey Ayupa, and I've got a ton of reports, and there's a lot of stuff in there. A lot of it's redacted. Now, redacted means they drew a black line through it, like names and things.
And locations and addresses.
Sometimes locations and addresses, but
mostly names.
Mostly names. And like they'd even redact, they were talking about getting information from a lieutenant, unknown Chicago Police Department. So even if a policeman was giving them information, when they release those reports, they'll redact the name. But not always, not always. Now, if a person was arrested with Ayupa and it was a criminal at the time or a mob guy, why they did not redact those names, as you'll see and as I go through this, what I've
through the reports. So they were quoted as known associates?
Well, they just, like these guys, were the managers of a couple of lounges. This is 1962, and the Bureau and their intelligence indicates that they're what they call syndicate-owned nightclubs, and they're owned by Joey Ayupa. And one was the Frolics at 4813 Cermak Road, and the other was Rose's Original Magic Lounge at 4820 Cermak Road, right across the street from each other. And this is in Cicero,
I believe. Is that kind of standard operation?
Well, what it was, like,
there was an article that just came out last Thursday in the Star, a local article, and they quoted two different addresses that were just, you know, doors down from each other on Broadway.
Were they clubs? Yeah.
Here they were clubs. So yeah. Here again in Chicago Joey Doves.
This is standard procedure that, and not particularly a mob procedure, but a nightclub procedure or restaurant procedure. You have Restaurant Row on 39th Street now, and you have different areas, and so they're kind of entertainment districts. And this was a red light entertainment district, not unlike our West 12th Street.
But it was in Cicero, Illinois.
And so these weren't the only two strip clubs. These were strip clubs in along this 4800 block of Cermak. There were others along there.
Are those buildings still there? Because this seems like great information to add to your Gangland Wire.
Yeah, if I
your mob expand, tour app.
Kansas City Mob Tour app.
Kansas City
if
mob
I
tour
expand
app.
To Chicago, why we can.
Well, you got
to
get it. That's how do you figure out that Chicago? You got to have like the Chicago button.
Well, yeah, I could. I just got to figure that one out. You know, you only got so many hours in the day.
I know. But you got so many addresses and so much great information.
Time consuming.
This Freedom of Information Act request.
Really.
Of which we've got a number of them in.
Now, if you remember, early in the series here, I talked about raiding a strip bar called the Bowery, and they were having live sex acts. And I actually worked inside undercover, and then I saw the live sex acts and went back and reported it. So the next Saturday night, this is like a Wednesday night, and that Saturday night we got a whole two or three squads of TAC officers and put some other vice guys inside, and we raided the club and arrested a couple of girls who had taking all her clothes off. At that time in Kansas City, it was illegal for a girl to take all of her clothes off, and arrested the couple of bikers. The bikers, I think it was El Forasteros or Galloping Gooses, one. They always provide the girls for strip clubs back then. And so arrested a couple of them. And
the bar owner?
You know, we didn't arrest him. We let him go, and here's why. We let him go because we wanted to see. He had claimed to informants that he had a connection with the police, and that's how he could operate this totally nude strip club. And so
without a license.
Well, he had a regular bar license.
A bar license, but it's another license to be able to operate a strip club, generally, isn't it?
You know, I don't think it was then. It probably has. It has since then. This was early on in that strip club thing, but I don't think it was then. Anyhow, so I was inside undercover, and I just stayed in there during the raid, and then they didn't close it clear down, so I stayed inside to see what he did. And, you know, and he did. He raised Cain, and he said, I'm going to call the captain. And he called the captain of Central Patrol down at the station, and he called down there and got the captain to come out. Well, I knew that captain. That captain was Mr. Square John from way back. And all this owner did was just bitch and piss and moan and complain about how they came in there and hauled these girls off and roughed up the clientele and then just left. So
and there was no donkey. I think it was.
And there was no donkey. That was one they claimed they were going to have a donkey act. Yeah. There was no donkey. Aaron still remembers the donkey. He's kind of
that episode is up there for folks. They can download it and listen to it.
Yeah. It's called the Bowery.
The Bowery, and you had to go in there, and you were forced under duty of law to witness their sex act.
Yeah, and drink all night.
And drink all night. Come back and write a report about it.
I couldn't do it today. You know, it's a good thing I was only 30 years old, 28 years old.
You probably at that point weren't a year from retirement.
Anyhow, we're going to talk about, I'll just tell you about the headline. State's attorney raids two Cicero clubs, 19 arrested. Now, I found this in this Freedom of Information Act documents I have on Joy Iupa. These two clubs were owned by Joy Iupa, which I said before. One of them was the Frolics at 4813 Cermak, and right across the street was the Rose's Original Magic Lounge at 4820. It's probably a strip like the West 12th Street Strip used to be a long time ago in Kansas City between 12th and on 12th Street between Wyandotte and Central, on the north side of the street across from what's the Barney Alice Plaza today and where is the Hilton, the Marriott Hotel today. Those were about 10 or 12 little strip clubs, and they all had strippers, dancers working in them. They didn't strip. They would just get up on a pedestal. They were go-go clubs.
Go-go clubs.
They were go-go clubs is what they called them. And then they'd get off. They'd get down with their act, and they'd come down and sit at the bar, and you could buy them an overpriced drink if you wanted to, and they'd flirt around with guys. And
you only know this because you had to go in there undercover.
Yeah, I only knew that because I was in there undercover.
Undercover, buying some overpriced drinks.
Yeah.
Having some conversation. How do you make up a conversation there, then?
Oh, you make it pretty easy to do. It's pretty easy to do.
How's the weather?
What time do you get off? I mean, no, I didn't say that.
No. There were other.
I remember this one girl.
There were other activities going on there. And didn't we do an episode and talked about some of this? Or if it was the same one where they were running some prostitution rings. And there was a local guy that you busted with the call service club.
No, that was out call escort service.
Yeah.
That was escort service. Yeah, this is a little bit different. Now, the girls wanted to make a deal that was pretty much on their own. I was talking to this one girl one night. And, what time do you get off? You know, trying to, you know, see what she might have in mind if she would, if she was.
Your wife doesn't listen to the podcast. Does
prostituting
she?
Herself. Well.
You're just working the job.
Yeah. And she said, you know, she said, I'm starving. I'm hungry. And she truly was hungry. It was like, I think maybe she didn't have enough money to eat. And she wanted me to take her out to eat. And I couldn't get her to trip for a sex act and a price. And I wasn't going to arrest her. I just wanted to see if she would go down that path. And she didn't go down that path. So this was in one of Camisano's clubs because I wanted to link Joe Camisano up to some of his girls tricking after hours, or maybe even while they were working at the club, going out and tricking guys, and I couldn't get her to. She wasn't tricking. She just wanted somebody to buy her something to eat. She She probably would have done something if I'd have bought her something to eat. She seemed that hungry.
But that didn't constitute the right act.
No, no. She was kind of jacked up on drugs, it seemed to me like, too.
Now,
so.
Now Joey Doves Iupa, he actually, what, then these buildings at 4813 Cermak Road and the other at 4820 Cermak Road across the street, were the buildings owned then by Joey Doves Iupa?
You know, I don't know. I didn't go in. He owned the business.
It didn't say in the...
It didn't say if he actually owned the building.
But he owned the business.
They said he had a financial interest in the business. I mean, these mob guys, they don't really... somebody's higher up, they don't really exactly own a business. They have an interest in it. You don't know...
What that is.
What that means. What does that mean to own a business? Now, they may go in and tell everybody what to do.
Well, I don't, you know, Joey probably wasn't in there managing the day-to-day operations.
They may take a management attitude when they go in. They may treat them like a manager, but you may never find any place where they own the business. So if he says he has a financial interest in it, and a guy of his stature in 1962, he owned the business.
Yeah, this is what
he was the boss.
What the FBI report said.
Right. You know, I'll tell you a little bit about, they did a raid the state's attorney's office. Now, the Cicero police, who ended up getting a little bit of trouble out of this, and this was outside of Chicago PD, but Chicago PD, they had just as many places over in Chicago that were operating openly. And so the state's attorney, which would be the county prosecuting attorney, they had their own investigative arm and their own the police department, if you will, and then they would maybe get local policemen, bring them in at the last minute on doing a raid like this. So they did a raid on these clubs. They had 22 state's attorney's officers that went in these two clubs, and they'd had undercover agents inside to see what was going on, just like we did here in Kansas City. And only in Kansas City, nobody tried to run out. They had never seen anything like this in, you know, probably 50 years in Kansas City when we did ours. But everyone started running outside, and they had people outside to grab them up and throw them in wagons when they ran out. So the officers go in and they take control of the club, and they make all the male employees stand behind the bar, and the strippers all have to line up on the stage and take pictures of them. And then they got all the customers and asked them, made them identify themselves and tell them where they lived. And then they took all the male employees and the strippers in for fingerprints and photographs, and they seized, the only weapons they found were several blackjacks carried by the male employees. Now, and the manager of the Frolics was a known IUPA associate named Sam Rizzo, and the manager of the Magic Lounge was another IUPA associate named Joe DeRosa. You know, when they're carrying those blackjacks, here's another complaint that the FBI reports talked about they had up there, and we had the same thing here in Kansas City, is... When you go into a mob-owned club or a mob-associate-owned club and you start creating trouble, they don't call the police. You wish they'd call the police. They don't call the police. They take you out and back and beat you within an inch of your life and tell you not to come back until you straighten out. And that's what those blackjacks were for. And those of you who are too young to know what a blackjack is usually a piece of lead covered by leather. Policemen used to carry them. When I first came on the police department, we called them slappers, and they're just one big flat piece of lead about 6 or 8 inches long and about 2 inches wide, and it's covered with a leather cover.
So it becomes like a handle.
So it's like a handle on it, and you could hit somebody at the flat part of that and not really cut them. Now, if you hit them with the edge of it, it'll cut them open. So you got to be careful and hit them with the flat part of it. Just a little inside knowledge about being a policeman in Kansas City back in the 60s and 70s. I never carried a slapper. It seemed kind of creepy to me.
You didn't hit anybody with it?
I didn't.
But you saw the results?
I was not a violent person. I could take care of business, but I was not a violent person. I didn't feel the need to do that. You know, and the reason this raid came about was not because... The local police department said they couldn't handle it. We've got these strip clubs and gambling, open gambling going on. It's because the Cicero Ministers Council. There was a council of local ministers, and everybody in the city knew about it. They knew they were operating openly.
And they had been for some time.
The Chicago Tribune reported that the Reverend Joseph Holbrook had stated, "When will our town officials wake up and take action against these cesspools of filth? How many raids by the state's attorney's office will it take to get them come to their senses?"
So this had happened before.
They'd happened before, and they'd raided them before, and nothing had happened to them.
They'd be raided, then they'd be down for a day, and then
about a year before, and
come back in business and same business as usual.
Sure, you know, and this is Cook County. The only thing the state's attorney at that time, Roswell T. Spencer, was a new broom who was sweeping clean. Probably the state's attorney before was in bed with them too, but this guy was not in bed with the mobsters, and he was taking some action.
Well, at this point, this is actually, you're looking at a Freedom Information Act document that was provided, that was an FBI. So that's a federal level investigation.
Well, see,
the
no,
state.
It wasn't. No, you got to understand how this works.
Is this a federal overview of the state operation?
Right. This is like an intelligence report for in 1962 by the FBI, who is reporting to their superiors. Well, this is what's going on in the mafia. In 1962 in Chicago.
Because I thought Chicago, their mob was in bed with the local politics.
They are. They weren't in bed with Roswell T. Spencer, but they were certainly in bed with, a county grand jury. The local state's attorney called the town president, a guy named Jerry Justine, and the chief of police, Jerry Justice, and a police captain whose name was Joseph Barloga, who was responsible for overseeing any kind of vice investigations in Cicero, and called them for a grand jury and asked them a number of hard questions. Now, nothing ever came out of it. They didn't indict anybody, but they did have a grand jury investigation of the town of Cicero and then the police department of Cicero.
And they came back with nothing.
They didn't come back with anything.
They're like, oh, okay, well, this is going on, but these guys don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just enough to make a statement like that, you know, this is serious. We're going to start looking at this, and we're going to call you in for a grand jury, and you may get indicted, you may not. Usually you don't, you have to have, you can call them in, and they're not going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I did it. I've been taking money from the mob. They're not going to do that.
No, they're not going to say
that. So now you got to get somebody from the mob to come in and say, yeah, we've been paying them off.
Nobody from the mob is going
to
do that.
Exactly. So, you know, it's all, you know, you just try to do something. And in Chicago, it's hard to get anything done.
I was watching
still
something
bad
on
today.
A YouTube video on the Chicago. I could say it's on the mob, but it was more about how Chicago and historically had been divided up into precincts.
Mm-hmm, you're right.
And all of these precincts, you know, there was people that were in positions of authority to place judges and
correct
sheriffs and
maybe get policemen
jobs,
get a certain person promoted to captain or to major or to commander, certain person to be transferred in or out if you were powerful in the precinct. We had the
Which
same
is a
thing.
Little harder to do if they're a state's attorney.
Well, the state's attorney, I mean, you know, sometimes a new broom sweeps clean. Sometimes in Kansas City in 1939, they had a bunch of non-Pendergast-dominated politicians won the election, and they swept everybody out. Like, every policeman in the Kansas City Police Department was fired in 1939.
Because they all got swept out.
Right, and they hired all new policemen. I used to always say, if you knew somebody, when I first came on, there are still just a few around from around that time. And if you knew somebody was on back then, they were probably dirty, or they were dirty back then for sure.
And they were just staying on for the dirt?
Yeah, it's their job. I mean, they just had to go.
They get their retirement after 25 years.
They just had to go on the down low a little more. And then it's just so hard to explain. These things are just impossible to explain to an outsider.
They could have rolled up with a single unit in a bad neighborhood at 27th in Brooklyn and seen that same minivan. And
they would have kept on going. Those guys didn't want to get involved with anything.
That's how come they've been on the force so long.
Right, exactly.
Well, now here, according to the intelligence report by the FBI, Judge Simon J.
Stefanowicz. Sigmund. It was the judge was Sigmund J. Stefanowicz. He got these cases. They charged several of the dancers with performing lewd acts, and they had five state's attorneys, investigators inside. It's like me being inside testifying. Yeah. I saw a live sex act. Saw women dancing without clothes, making obscene gestures. Now, I'm not sure. They didn't go into detail what the obscene gestures was. One can leave that to one's imagination, I think, I guess. What do you think it was, Aaron?
Well, they probably weren't flipping them off.
Probably not. They were probably doing some things with their fingers.
They were probably maybe shaking their money makers.
At least.
But, I mean, if you're like, you think somebody has to call and go, listen, we've got you. You need to go to Cicero to this club. And I just want you to hang out for a while and report back on what happens. And these guys had to know that this was already a known mob location.
The
state's investigators that where they would send in.
Cicero Ministers Council already knew that. They
probably had been in there observing the Ludacs themselves.
Been in there doing that themselves. They just didn't tell anybody. Maybe
they got the bad end of the blackjack, and that's why they were so upset.
Here's how it goes down. You pick it up from your neighbor, maybe, or you pick it up from a street source, an informant, and they say, down there, here's what they're doing. Or you say, oh, IOPA's got that club. What's going on down there? And they'll say, oh, this, this, and this. So you'll send somebody down there to have a couple of drinks, and they come back and say, looks like it's going on.
It was or wasn't.
Yeah. That's how it went down in Kansas City, and that's how it always works. Stefanowicz, do you think he was in bed with him?
Wait a second. Here in the notes, it says that he acquitted.
Right.
The dancers. He didn't. So they were charged. They had five state's investigators that came forward on a stand to say, yeah, these girls were committing lewd acts and gestures. And and the judge said, I don't believe you.
Right.
That the grounds and the evidence are not sufficient to press charges.
And he also let the managers go, too.
And where was he? He was a judge for that precinct.
Probably, I'm not sure how it's broken down. Now in Missouri, it would be since it was state's attorney, it would have to be a state circuit court judge is what you would have in Kansas City. Probably be an associate circuit court judge. It would hear those smaller police cases and traffic tickets that were written by state troopers and county sheriffs. Wouldn't be a city court. It would be a state court.
But in Chicago, are those elected officials or are those appointed? And I thought in Chicago, having watched some of this YouTube stuff, maybe that they were in fact appointed positions.
I think maybe those judges are appointed. In Missouri, we have the Missouri plan, and a lot of states have the Missouri plan for appointing judges. And so the first time you get appointed, there'd be a committee of people from the bar and citizens, which, you got your committee in Chicago when the whole city, the whole county and the two or three counties around are pretty corrupt. You put who you want on that committee. You put the head of the mafia on that committee and who picks the judges if you want.
They would still get away with
it. And then you have to run for retention after that. That's why we do it in Missouri now. I think they're appointed up there, and I don't know if they have the Missouri plan or not. Probably not. You're probably appointed basically for life or as long as you kick back to the local political leader every once in a while. We had the same setup in Kansas City for a long time. It was wards, first ward, second ward, mm-hmm. third ward. And we had a ward boss. Each ward had a boss, and that boss.
Those bosses in the Northeast were.
Right, exactly.
Were representative.
Johnny
Lazier
was
there.
The first ward boss for a long time, from over in the North End, what we call the North End. But Stefanowicz, he even when the Reverend Holbrook criticized them, he came right back in the newspapers and he was quoted saying, it's my opinion that Reverend Holbrook should resign as leader of the ministerial council. He has made statements critical of the judiciary and has shown no positive action. What is needed is not words, but action. I followed the law in this case. So, who knows?
He followed the law in this case, and it was said that I don't have to explain, but the state has not proven its case against the manager. So Sam Rizzo walks.
Right.
Joe DeRosa walks. Assumably. These dancers who remain unnamed walk.
I've got their names. Hold on a minute. I got their names somewhere.
Did they actually have the names of the girls in the FOIA?
They did.
While you're looking that up, folks, remember to put a hit out on our donate button. It does not cheap for us to file for those Freedom of Information Act requests when sometimes 22,000 pages come back. And it's $625 if you want them all. Now, right. We're going to probably narrow that down a bit, so we wouldn't need that much from you.
Okay, I've got them. The women on trial are Virginia Clough, Wilmer Ziegler. I don't know if that's supposed to be Wilma or Wilmer. Wilmer Ziegler, Jean Fitzgerald, and Deborah Lane. They ranged in age from 26 to 32.
and we're all probably residents in the community there somewhere, whether it was Cicero or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They probably lived within a block or two of that place. Like I talked about how they don't call the police. That's why they had those blackjacks. Here's another article that, or a quote from the FBI reports. Patrons tell of beating. Complaints about the Magic Lounge are not new, investigators said. Last November 21st, three men complained to the Tribune that they had been beaten, kicked, and robbed of $50 after refusing to buy high-priced drinks for hostesses. They reported the alleged assault to Cicero police, who asked the complainants to take a sobriety test. The men refused, and no action was taken.
But so the Cicero police, much like the judges and other people in the precinct or ward, were maybe turned a blind eye to some of the activities that were going on. I mean, they roll up on a call. Here's three guys who were probably beaten up. And, yeah, maybe they have been drinking, and they want to complain because of the assault. And the first thing the officers do is ask them to take a field sobriety test. They don't open the door and go, well, you're telling me there's activity going on in here? Is that what the complaint is, or is it the beating?
Well, that's Chicago. That's Cicero.
These guys should have known better. Why were they doing there to begin with?
Exactly. You know, you bought your ticket.
Now you get to take the ride.
Right. Another interesting article from the Chicago Daily News in 1962. The Senate rackets probers aim to expose a sword slice of syndicate salami April 3rd. That's the date on the subpoena they finally slapped on Joey Iupa, the outfit's Cicero vice boss. They've got a dozen B-girls ready, they hope, to tell how the hoods forced them to hustle customers in a local sin spots. Could get very messy. So it was pretty colorful times back in back then, the newspapers and the way they wrote it up.
And the way they reported it, and the girls were forced into this position of, they were just looking for a regular job when they went through the door and saw.
Oh, well, they probably knew what they were getting
into.
Other
go-go girls dancing away.
I think these girls always know what they're getting into. And you know, I don't like to blame the victim, because in a way they are a victim. I once knew one of these gals had danced in one of these strip clubs, and she had gotten away from that life. And she told me, she said, any time you see a girl working as a dancer in one of these strip clubs, that they have probably been sexually abused as a child, or some kind of abuse by men as a child. Mm-hmm. And so... They have, not saying everybody's like that or that's a prerequisite, but
that seems to be kind of a common.
That was her take on it, and she had been sexually abused as a child too. So that's kind of, I have to agree with her. You know, there's probably something wrong with somebody that does that. And I don't, by wrong, there's something horrible that's happened in her past that caused her to then end up to be in that position in life.
Yeah, to do that. I mean, some of them, it may be drugs or alcohol or...
Right. I mean, there's a combination thereof.
Also just acting out from those kind of past issues.
Those past issues, exactly. And then drugs and alcohol to cover up that pain, and then they end up with the other. So we're an amateur psychologist here, waxing eloquently. You know, in 1962, another kind of another cool story in Chicago is how wide open it was. There was what they called a floating crap game that had moved around Chicago that was huge. Maybe there'd be 100 people. There would be more than one table. They would get, in the backs of...
Semis?
Semis. No, in the backs of high-end clubs, in country clubs, in warehouses, but they would just move around periodically. So you kind of had to be in the know to know where it was, even though they didn't really have to. But they didn't want the state's attorney coming after them. They didn't want to be robbed. Lots of times those other criminals are out looking for that opportunity. That's how Nick Civella got in trouble, was robbing a protected gambling game in Kansas City.
Now, when they say protected, what they really mean is...
it's mafia-owned.
Yeah, the mob is protecting their illegal gaming.
Right. There's a pretty
protected gaming. It's not like, well, I'm a gambler, let me go in there because they've got protection.
Yeah. Well, they've got protection from the law enforcement, and it's just protected from the other criminals, although it doesn't always work. Now, like I said, that's what Nick Civella got in trouble for, was robbing protected games. And that means the mob gets a piece of it. But have you ever seen, there's a movie called Rob the Mob. It's a really good movie. It's about this man and woman, a young couple in I think it was in New York City or back east somewhere.
It's a true story.
True story, large city back east. Now, this is a narrative movie, but it's based on real events. And they thought, well, who should we rob that they won't go complaining to the police? And the guy was kind of had some connections and knew where the different mob kind of games and clubs were. And so they started robbing the mob clubs, and they robbed about 8 or 10 of them before they finally got caught. And the mob was after them big time. Somebody, I believe, you know, I can't remember the end of it now, but it's a
good movie.
I shouldn't tell you the end
of it.
What's
the name of it?
Rob the Mob. It's a really good, kind of a minor movie. You probably find it on Amazon, probably rent it on Amazon. It only had about a 2-week run, maybe a week here in the theaters, but I heard about it. You know, and I heard about it from a guy who used to be one of those guys when he was young and crazy and a professional criminal. And he robbed, one of the main things he was robbing was going around the country, just like the guy that was in the paper the other day, Sam Palma, and robbing grocery stores.
Yeah, supermarkets.
That's where the money was.
Had the money.
But this guy would have robbed a game or two himself when he was young. And he saw that movie and he got a hold of me and said, oh, you got to see this movie. It's the best mob movie I've seen in a long time. So I saw it and it was good. So I'd highly recommend it. But anyhow, this was the biggest floating crab game in Chicago. And it was wide open in Chicago. But like I said, they moved around because they didn't want to get hit by thieves, and there's no use rubbing it in the police face either. I mean, just you can only go so far, and it becomes embarrassing. And when the local ministers start complaining, you got to do something.
Well, I mean, at the point that they're, having already been raided, and then reopen and reoperate, do the same operations, and then get raided again, I imagine.
And getting everybody found not guilty reopening again.
And probably just reopening again. I mean, this is one. You know, kind of a sampling, an intelligence report, as you call it, from the Freedom of Information Act request.
That was Chicago in 1962. But this is not part of this. This was over in Chicago. That was in Cicero. But this was a mob protected, the biggest floating crap game in Chicago. And at one point in time, they had rented a large Quonset hut kind of a building. It was located really close to a well-known nightclub called La Villa Venice. Now, if you're from Chicago, listener, you probably will remember this Villa Venice because they had hosted nationwide acts. And like they had Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and the Rat Pack there for 2 weeks one time. And during those 2 weeks, this gambling game, this floating dice game, got so popular that supposedly they took in over $200,000 during that 2-week appearance by the Rat Pack. It's such an easy thing to do. I don't know who there would have been I think it was maybe Jackie Cerrone's brother. His last name was Cerrone, was the operator of it. And he was a mob connected guy, of course.
There would be a main executor of what was going on.
Right. And so he set up a limo shuttle service between the Villa Venice nightclub and the game at the Quonset hut was only about 2 blocks away. And
you don't have an address for that?
No, I don't. But
the Villa Venice traffic, probably still there.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it is. I don't have any idea. This is just an old report. They talked about it. And I didn't really go into it. They didn't have an address on it. I didn't go into it any further. Traffic jams were created around this club, especially during those 2 weeks of people trying to get to the nightclub to see the Rat Pack and people trying to get to the game and then people trying to get from the game back over to the nightclub, from nightclub to the game. So that was, and nothing ever happened on that.
They were just basically, keeping them under surveillance as this was going on.
I don't think anybody was doing anything. This was all reported afterwards by somebody else. I don't think the law enforcement didn't have anything. If they did, they probably acted.
The local law enforcement.
Local law enforcement probably acted as bouncers and protectors.
And security. Yeah,
and security during this time, more than likely. So anyhow, that's about all I got here about Joy Iupa and being the vice lord of 1960 Chicago and Cicero. I just say Chicago and I mean Cicero and what is it, Elmhurst and some of those other
really
little
the
suburban country.
The suburbs
cities.
Of.
They're actually all part of Chicago now. Back then, I think they each had a individual government probably somebody listening to this from Chicago can email me and set me straight on how this politically is broken down in jurisdictions today, if it's different today than it was back then. Now, back then, they had the Cicero town president. They had the Cicero chief of police, Cicero police commander, who were called in front of the state's attorney. So it wasn't Chicago PD, or they would the FBI reports would have said it was Chicago PD. So that's I think that's all we got on that. I've got another one I need to edit and get it in a can, and I should have three or four more up real quick, and we'll try to keep those coming, folks. And if you've got any suggestions,
I was going to just say we are waiting on the Freedom Information Act request.
That's going to be a while. Yeah.
Junior Bradley.
Even when I get that, it's so voluminous, it's going to be a while before I can really do justice by it. There's so much. It's an interesting story. I even think it ought to write a true crime book about this, showing how the mob and the black dope dealers were in bed with each other in Kansas City. I won't be very popular among the mob, will I?
I don't think you are now, are you?
Probably not.
They just had this article come out in the Kansas City Star last Thursday. We were talking about this before the recording session, and I work at Chubby's on Broadway, and that was, some of the folks that were the owners and operators of that establishment purported to have some connection.
Organized crime connections.
Although all I ever knew, any of the folks, owners, operators, sons thereof, family members who may be there as just upstanding citizens doing the job that you would do if you owned a restaurant.
And, right.
But Uncle Frank was honestly visibly kind of, you could see he was a little shaken sitting there in the morning before he drove his lunch truck out to service everybody. And he's reading the Star article, and there's this whole story about it. You know, I didn't know anything about it. And they asked me, did you know about this? Because I've got the inside source, you know.
I was quoted in that article.
Yeah, well, and that was the other part, of course. Then they're reading through it, and then Gary Jenkins and Gangland Wire quoted in it, so it made it more obvious that I should have known something about it.
Oh, it was an old story. I don't know if I'll ever get around to telling that one. Sam Palma was a kind of a minor guy. He was going around.
He robbing grocery stores.
Robbing grocery stores. And he was found dead on his father's grave one morning. The morning of he was supposed to go to trial.
His two co-defendants
pled guilty later that week. And the story was that he was refusing to plead guilty and just go away. And they wanted to plead guilty because they were afraid that something would come out about the mob, or they were afraid that he might even make a deal and talk. I don't think he would have, but those are the stories. And now the family claims it was suicide.
Yeah. Uncle Frank, who was probably five at the time, said they told me it was a suicide.
Right. And a friend of mine, actually Ray Kenny, who was an intelligence detective from the time they started the unit, actually back in these early days in the 60s, taught me everything I knew. And he told me that the night before they found Sam Palma dead in the cemetery, the last person that he was seen with, and Ray saw him himself, he was driving by a Katz drugstore that had a soda fountain that was open late at night, and he saw Tuffy DeLuna and Sam Palma, and they're having coffee together. And when Ray was getting off pretty quick and he went on home, there wasn't any real reason to sit there and watch him for anything. Just note that, yeah, they were there. It would be normal for them to be there late at night having coffee together. I think they were maybe second cousins or something.
Where was that? What was the restaurant?
Katz restaurant. Katz drugstore at 40th and Main. It's where the, I don't know. It's some kind of a startup incubator now, I think. It's where the clock is at 40th and Main on the building. It used to be a drugstore.
Yeah, it was a CVS for a CVS, while, but that was the location. Another spot for your app.
Kansas City
Mob Tours.
Kansas City Mob Tours. This is a spot where I have to do a whole story on Sam Palma.
Yeah,
I guess.
Last seen alive, Sam Palma with Tuffy DeLuna.
And then show where his grave was. That'd be a more important site because they found his body out there. And I've got a few graves in there anyhow. But anyhow, one would believe that Tuffy DeLuna, if that's the last person you're with, and then they find you dead the next day, who would be the number one suspect?
The last person you were seen with.
Exactly. Ask Stephen Avery of the Making a Murderer. Huh?
But as we would always talk about how these things go down for the mob, it's always a two-man team.
Oh, yeah. There have been more than Tuffy, but
And that I thought in the article it wrote that there was blood found in his car.
Right. They probably, in his car. Probably got him out, had him drive. Somebody got in the front seat, the passenger side, and somebody else got in the back seat and probably just popped him as he drove down the street. Got him to stop. Guy said, hey, pull over here and go to the, I got to go take a pee. Pull over here by this park or this alley and pop him when he got there. And then just slide him over, jump in the driver's seat and go dispose of the body and then go drop the car off.
Kind of an odd way to dispose of the body, though, to take it well, back over to the graveyard.
That's what's interesting. That was from. I would love to know the what the imagery, the message. That was some kind of a message, and I don't know what it was. Maybe the family knows, though, that they will not refuse. They will refuse to believe that's anything but suicide. So I don't know. It's kind of a delicate subject, and family members are still around. They're still alive. I know a guy that's married to one of his daughters, and I know another guy who was married to the other one of his daughters who has died since then. But you know,
but there's still family out there.
There's still a lot of family out there.
They still remember that too, and that's an emotional subject, especially when it shows up in like page 4 of the Kansas City Star.
I had
top of the fold article with a big picture of Tuffy DeLuna. And
yeah, I had Tuffy's nephew in one of my screenings of Gangland Wire, and we talked afterwards. He said it was so weird to hear his uncle's voice on that screen. Just weird. And it would be.
And Uncle Frank, I had given him a copy of Gangland Wire to watch.
He probably said the same thing.
He said it was eerie.
Eerie to hear their voices.
Because that was their voices.
Yeah, it was. It was their voices.
And they knew that because they knew those men. Right.
Those were not actors reading lines.
No,
were
not
they?
At all. Which is what makes the movie great.
Right. That's the reason I did it. That's when I main reason I did that movie, Aaron, is because when I got all those wiretaps, I thought I can let the mob guys tell their story out of their own mouth. Not some expert, not some policeman or some wannabe or some lawyer or author or historian telling their story. They can tell their story. This is what we did. So that's why I even made the movie. I wouldn't have made the movie if I couldn't have got those wiretaps.
As you had said to me one time, it was the crimes from the mouths of the men that did them.
Correct.
And that's, I think, I'm telling you, if it's the, you know, if you give us a review and you live outside the United States, not inside the United States where it's cheap to mail a DVD or a T-shirt if you give us a review, but outside the United States, which, you know, maybe those folks inside the United States, they might like, a, you know, 30 minutes of a conversation that does, maybe they can't understand.
Yeah.
But we could clip it out.
I can get you the transcript and get you the audio. The problem is, I don't know what to get you of it is just boring.
I would give them, you know, just, you know, you could pick something that maybe you had distilled down from your movie, but it came from a larger piece.
Yeah, I could do that. I could give more of the Marlowe tape. Marlowe tape's really interesting where they describe how they steal from casinos. I just used a little snippet of it. So it I got a lot of good stuff in it. And it's real understandable. You almost don't even need the transcript for the Marlowe.
I mean, just the fact that actually it's their voices and having them talking about really anything is, I think, a unique and interesting piece. You know, sometimes, you know, pot of peep, pot of poot, what's that?
Yeah.
Like some of the
peep,
language.
Pop, yeah.
Yeah, some of the language that they use, which is their, I guess it's a genuine.
Yeah, I tried to pull some of it
language.
Out. Right. Well, they said Minga, Minga Marone, and my Mugari. That's what he told Tony Spilotro. He said something about my Mugari's out here. Tuffy DeLuna was having a conversation with Tony Spilotro out in Las Vegas. They're talking about getting together, and Tuffy said something about his Mugari's out there, and Tony Spilotro says, huh? And he says, oh, I forgot, you don't speak Italian.
Now, what's a Mugari?
Your wife.
Your wife.
So, all right, let's wind this down now.
Give a few thank yous. Remember, of course, to give us a review for that digital download if you're outside the United States. And if you're inside the United States, give us a review on iTunes. It helps out the search engines to help us find us. And let us know what you think. And Gary Jenkins says he'll send you a DVD.
Yep. I might even send you a T-shirt if that's what you want. I've got a few left. They're going fast. I don't know if I'll order any more. I probably will. Depends on...
T-shirts are expensive.
I know. It depends on how this goes, whether I order any more or not. But if we keep this thing going for a while... I know it's a Generation Y guy. If you like this true crime, this podcast, Generation Y is an interesting... It's like us. It's not slick and done by the people at
NPR.
NPR. it's kind of homespun, but they have really interesting take. I was just listening to their discussion on the Making a Murder, and it is really thought provoking. I like they had some insightful things to say about it. So try that one out.
Generation Y.
Generation Y. WHY.
Also like to give a shout out to the band Odd-O-Matic at Odd-O-Matic Music for providing that musical bumper bed that we bring the show in on and end it with.
Okay.
Check them out. And, of course, the Big Dumb Fun Show. I'm Aaron Gnerk, host and producer. You can find us usually here live Mondays from 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We're online at BigDumbFunShow.com. And check out another project that I'm doing. We're going to have to do a crime one and have you come in and make fun of another crime.
I know.
Movie.
We tried that with the No Country for Old Men. I'm not very funny. Anyhow.
But I do another project called Sarcasm Cinema where we basically take good movies and get comics in and make fun of a good feature film.
All right.
So if you have a friend or neighbor, coworker, family member who has a drug addiction problem, alcohol, sex, gambling, make your first call to firstcallkc.org. And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app.
From iTunes. iTunes only.
iTunes only.
We're not on Google Play. Man. Okay. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Gary. Thanks.